Welcome to Destination Murder, the true crime podcast.
Each week the hosts, that's us, BFS Megan
and Tegan,
cover stories from a new part of the world.
Get ready to combat your travel bug and feed your true crime obsession.
Welcome back, one and all. Welcome back, Tegan.
Welcome back, listeners. Welcome back, Megan.
So glad to be back. It feels like we haven't done this in forever. We took Easter long weekend off, so there was no episode last week. And every time we do this, it feels like we're starting all over.
I know, right? When Megan and I do this over Zoom, and when I was logging in, I was like, what is the password? Like, I don't remember off the top of my head anymore. I was like, am I going to have to look it up? But I remembered it, so it's fine.
Good job, Tegan.
Thank you.
You've got such a great brain.
I know, right? It's so fantastic. My brain is the most amazing brain in the entire world. Thank you and good night.
Even better than Albert Einstein's.
Yeah. E equals MC squared. Who?
T equals MC squared.
T equals MF squared.
Yeah. Is Albert Einstein's brain in a jar somewhere?
I don't know.
For some reason, I feel like it is.
For some reason, I feel like Walt Disney's brain is somewhere. I know that he was frozen, but I feel like I've also heard that they just kept his brain in a jar.
Maybe they just froze his brain to, like, transplant the body.
Maybe. I don't understand why you'd want to bring anyone back. It's too early for... I have now taken to drinking iced coffee.
I saw. I'm jealous.
My roommate got me on it. Starbucks has, like, these, like, creamers that are delicious. So I only drink it if it's, like, 3/4 creamer and 1/4 coffee. But I'm drinking the cinnamon dolce creamer and coffee that was left in our fridge. So that's fine.
Nice. Do you get the creamers from the grocery store or from Starbucks?
Yeah, from the grocery store. Although they have been selling out really quickly.
Are they new?
I think so. I think there's like 4 flavors. There's like the caramel macchiato one. There's a vanilla one, I think. And then there's one other flavor. But yeah, they're all like really good. So
I bet they're selling out really quickly because it's a trend on TikTok to like show how you make your iced coffee. Have you seen those?
Yeah. But I haven't seen anyone use the Starbucks ones.
Oh, I've seen them use it.
Yeah. Interesting. Usually it's just like some girl putting like caramel sauce into a jar and then like a splash of coffee and then like 4 different types of creamers. And mm-hmm. then, like, whipped cream and, like, chocolate chisel.
Yeah, and then there's that one guy that reviews them. He's like, creamer? More creamer? Oh, that's gonna be a lot of milk.
Yep. this is good.
Well, while Tegan shoves her face in her iced coffee, I guess I'll introduce the show. This is Destination Murder. I'm Megan.
I'm Tegan.
The slight delay is you swallowed your coffee. But yeah, every week we travel to a different part of the globe to cover a new murder case or true crime case or whatever from another country. And then at the end, we pull a new country, state, city, province, whatever. And that's where we go next week. So we've got Instagram at Destination Murder Pod. We've got Twitter at @dest_murder. We've got Facebook Destination Murder. I always forget that one. Now I will never forget it because I always forget to mention it. Who's on Facebook nowadays anyways, right?
I am.
So am I, but the only person who ever like tags me in anything is my mom.
I tag you sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm
my mom though.
I am, even though I'm 3 days younger than you. I've, like, really been getting into Facebook recently because I have joined a community group for the city that I live in, and it is amazing.
Is there a lot of, like, drama?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
The big thing right now is that there was a power outage a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to cut down this tree because it fell onto some wires. So instead of taking it to the dump, they like cut up the tree into like little logs, and they've been placing them around the parks to like naturally decompose, and people are upset. They're like, you ruined the English garden in this area that I used to walk by every day, and it was so beautiful, and now there's just stumps everywhere, and it's so disgusting. The city of that I'm in just wants to save money and not actually dispose of their garbage properly.
Okay, a tree isn't garbage. It's compost. It's way better for everyone if we put it in the park to let it decompose.
Yeah.
Just think of all the bugs that you've made a new home for.
Yeah, and they won't go in your house now.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. And, like, lots of... But it's also great because they, like, shout out a lot of, like, little restaurants and stuff in my area. So my roommate and I have found a whole bunch of cool places to check out and support in our community. So, yeah.
Especially since restaurants are struggling right now with all the new restrictions.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me. Right now, we're in BC, BC, Canada, and the COVID restrictions, they kind of like locked down-ish last week, I think it is now, but they closed all the indoor dining, but then left like malls and big box stores open.
I don't understand.
Just does not make sense to me.
I honestly believe that we need to go into a full lockdown to like solve anything. And I think that when we're in like this gray zone, people bend the rules because there's no structure, and it's like, well, how long is this going to last for? If you say we're going into a full shutdown for a month and then, you know, we'll start to slowly lift things like they did before, that I need a timeline. I need something, because this honestly feels worse than when we were in full lockdown.
I've heard on the rumor mill that BC might have like a full shutdown, like a stay-at-home order like Ontario has right now. So the rumor says that's coming on Monday. We're recording this Saturday. Episode comes out Wednesday, so we'll all know by the time this episode comes out whether those rumors were just rumors or if they were true.
Yeah, you can sit there and laugh at us and go, ha ha ha, you were so wrong, you stupid little girls. Or you can be, ha ha ha, wow, these girls are so smart. 10 out of 10, they guess the future.
Yeah, well, we've chatted for a lot. Should we get into our cases?
Probably. Probably.
Who's first?
I'm first. I am doing a case from Martinique, in case anyone forgot.
I forgot. Thank you for reminding me.
You're so welcome, Megan. I'm just going to move some stuff around on my screen so I can see Megan while I'm talking, because I always have to see her beautiful face. So I feel like I kind of cheated again, because I'm doing a case of someone who's not from Martinique, but I'm covering a case that happened in Martinique. So
that's okay.
This is the life and death of Mark Blitzstein. My sources this week are Wikipedia, New York Times, and Britannica. So, let's jump right on in. So, Mark Blitzstein was born on March 2nd, 1905, to the son of a South Philadelphia banker, Samuel M. Blitzstein, and Anna Lovett Blitzstein. The boy's mother was very fond of singing, and he was attracted to the family's living room piano shortly after he began to walk. At the age of three, he was playing by ear the works of Offenbach, and Mendelssohn music his father whistled around the house. So that's a fun time. Immediately, the family hired musical tutors, fearing that the boy might otherwise play on by ear. At six, he made his first of many public appearances in Philadelphia. after attending a West Philadelphia high school where he was born and raised. As every time I read that line, I was just like, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
You can't not.
Yeah.
When else does West Philadelphia come up in conversation?
Only when you're talking about the life of Mark Blitzstein, really. So he went to high school and then he went to University of Pennsylvania from 1921 to 1923 on a scholarship. He then went to Curtis Institute to study music, and in 1927, he went to the Academie der Kunst in Berlin with Arnold Schoenberg, whom he did not get along with.
I didn't know you spoke German, Tegan.
I know, right? I don't know why the Academy. I can say de Kunst.
Academy de Kunst.
Kunst. But the Academy. Academy de Kunst. Afterwards, he went to Paris and studied with Nadia Boulanger, whom he did get along with. Despite his later political beliefs, he was, in the early years of his career, a self-proclaimed and unrepentant artistic snob who firmly believed that true art was only for the intellectual elite. And he was very vocal in denouncing composers who he felt debased their standards to reach a wider public.
Wow, that's very classist.
Right?
It's like, you're trying to raise yourself out of poverty, but no, you gotta stay down there. I'm gonna kick you while you're down.
Well, it's just like, or like, people who are of upper class making music or art for the masses is suddenly like not okay because it's only meant for like the richest of riches.
It's like only if you have generational wealth can you listen to my music.
Yeah.
You can't listen to it in your factory. I'm sorry. It's not for you.
Could they even listen to music in factories in the 20s?
I don't know. If they put it on like a big record thing or a jukebox. The factory manager's like, everyone, you're listening to Bach today. Puts it into the jukebox.
I don't think, were there jukeboxes? I think it was.
I'm making this up, Tian.
I think it was the turntables. Is that what it's called? Record player. Just put the record player in front of the speaker and over the, for the announcements and just play.
Like a big gramophone or whatever.
Yeah. Anyways, his works of this period were mostly pianistic vehicles, such as the piano sonata in 1927 and the piano concerto in 1931, are typical of the Boulanger-influenced products of American modernism, strongly rhythmic, though not influenced by jazz, and described by himself as wild, dissonant, and percussive. His career, however, had its days of conflict and controversy, beginning in 1937 when his pro-labor operetta, The Cradle Will Rock, sponsored by the Federal Theater Project, was ordered off stage by federal edict. The grounds for the order were that the Works Project administration were being reorganized and the personnel was being cut. The producers, Orson Welles and John Houseman, having already sold the tickets and believing that they had a superb production, hired their own theater. The WPA actors remained off stage so that technically they weren't violating an actor's equity order against participating in the unauthorized presentation, and the show went on. So the actors spoke their lines and sang their parts from the floor, and Mr. Blitzstein, so Mark, not affected by anyone's edict, sat at the piano at the center of the stage, the spotlight picking him out against the blue backdrop, and played the entire score while narrating the operetta.
Wait, so he was playing the piano and narrating as well?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And all the actors basically sat in, like, with the audience because they weren't allowed to be on stage.
And it's so weird.
I know, right? Apparently pro-union operettas were blasphemy in 1937.
Oh no.
Oh no, 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 no.
I love being in a union.
Are you unionized?
Yeah, my job is unionized.
Oh, that's fun.
And I love it. Every time I see that a job is unionized, I'm like, yes, I'm going to get paid more. Yes, I'm going to have health care.
I'm not unionized. I've never been in a union. I don't know what it's like.
I've been in two unions.
Ooh, Megan's so fancy.
I know. They were my two highest paid jobs. Ooh. Lots of fun. Highly recommend.
Mark's next opera was about the workers, and it was called No for an Answer. Aroused opposition from New York's license commissioner, who discovered that the Mecca Temple on West 55th Street did not have a theater license and that alleged building violations prevented issuing a permit. The opera eventually did have its run in 1941, but some critics considered it to lack the wit and inspiration of The Cradle Will Rock. Additional major compositions included the radio song, play I've Got the Tune, the Airborne Symphony, Regina, Reuben Reuben, and Juno. At the time of his death, Mark was working on Idiot's First, a one-act opera based on the eponymous story of Bernard Malland. This was followed by the work Mark intended to be his magnum opus, a three-act opera commissioned by the Ford Foundation and optioned by the Met Opera, entitled Sacco and Vanzetti. Both tales of Malmund and Sacco and Vanzetti were completed posthumously with the approval of Mark's estate by the composer Leonard Lehrman. Mark was a slender and quiet man without the moody temperament associated with the artistic world. His only visible eccentricity was his mustache, which he would shave off impulsively only to start regrowing it immediately.
Sounds like me with my hair. Every, 6 months, I'm like, I'm cutting it all off.
And then I'm growing it all back, and then I'm cutting it all off.
Yeah.
But I love that that was like, whoa, he's so eccentric. He just shaved off his mustache, and now he's going to grow it back again.
He's so crazy. He's not like other boys.
He's so kooky.
He's so kooky and unique. Oh my gosh.
He was also openly gay. But I think that's that must have been very trying.
This is in the 1930s and 40s?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really rough for him.
The 1920s to 1950s, basically. Mm-hmm. He wrote to his sister in 1929 regarding prior attempts to suppress or hide his orientation, saying, "It is absurd to assume that there are no sins. There are definitely cardinal sins, sins against oneself, against one's laws. My sin has been the willingness to corrupt my nature." His first lover was the conductor Alexander Smolens, whom he traveled to Europe with in 1924. Mark nevertheless married novelist Eva Goldbeck in March 2nd, 1933. They had no children. Eva's mother was the Berlin-born musical star and opera singer Lena Abarbanel. He dedicated a number of his works, including Romantic Piece for Orchestra, String Quartet, The Italian, The Ballet Cain, and The Serenade for String Quartet to Eva. Unfortunately, she did die of anorexia in 1936, and his grief prompted him to throw himself into the works of creating The Cradle Will Rock. Anorexia is a very deadly mental illness. It is. has the highest mortality rate out of any mental illness in Canada. So it needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
That one hit a little hard. Hit home. And go to therapy. People get help for your mental illnesses. Mark also served in the army in World War II. And that's all the information I have about that. In 1958, Mark was subpoenaed to appear before the U.S. House Committee on Un-American Activities, also known as the HUAC. Appearing first in a closed session, Mark admitted to his membership in the Communist Party, ending in 1949. I know.
Scandal. Mark, not communism.
He's gay, he's an artist, and he's a communist.
Oh, no. Okay, why is he a communist and then says that art is only for, like, the highest class?
I don't know.
Maybe he changed his mind.
And then also very union.
He's pro-union then?
He was pro-union.
Okay. I thought he was anti-union, and that's why he made all of the actors sit on the...
No.
Sit on...
No.
It wasn't him that made that.
Yeah, the union shut him down. So, or...
Oh, I see.
Is union and communism correlated?
Yeah, I think so. Because in communism and socialism, like, the workers control the means of production. And so having a union is, like...
This is true.
The representatives of the workers, like, directly.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I feel like I learned about communism and then was completely like, this is not knowledge that I need. Leave my brain. And that is Social Studies 11 for you. He challenged the right of the HUAC to question him at all. He refused to name names or cooperate any further. He was recalled for further public sessions, but after a day of sitting anxiously in a waiting room, he was not called to testify. So, here's where our story begins. Mark moved to Martinique in November 1963. He was there to swim, which apparently was his only hobby, and to finish composing several operas. So Mark was found in Fort de France, being badly mauled and shouting for help. The police took Mark to the hospital, where he died after treatment nearly 24 hours later at 50 years old. On January 25th, the police said two Portuguese sailors and one from Martinique, whose names were never released, got into a dispute with the composer on a Tuesday night, January 22nd. Megan.
My birthday.
Yeah. Your birthday is cursed. That's when Mark was beaten up. How dare you?
Sorry. It all correlates to my birth on that day, like, 40 years later.
Yeah, exactly. And the details were sketchy. They said that the three suspects apparently had been drunk at the time of the attack. It is said that he had been flirting with one of the men and made a proposition to him. And I guess they did not like that. So they took him out to the street and just, like, beat the living hell out of him. Beat him to death, quite literally. I think it's so funny that they say proposition, because all of these were, like, archived articles from the New York Times. And I was like, he propositioned the three sailors.
Like, did he, though? That's the thing. Maybe just him talking to them and them realizing he was gay. They were like, oh my god, he's propositioning us. Like,
oh
no,
my god,
he's just having a conversation with you.
So Abraham Friedman, attorney for the Blitzstein family, said that William E. Milam, U.S. vice consul in Martinique, had informed a member of the family that the police were investigating something suspicious about the death. Mr. Friedman said that the U.S. consulate had sent a cablegram on Wednesday to his sister, Ms. Edward Davis, of Philadelphia, informing her that Mark had been injured in an automobile accident and asking her to telephone the consulate. So, one, what the hell is a cablegram? Two, why would they tell her that it was an automobile accident? In the beginning.
Did they think it was a car accident at the beginning?
I don't know, because here's what the next part is. However, this is sad. His sister was not at home. So the cable was read to her mother, who was 81 years old. And when his sister did arrive home about 1 hour later, a second cablegram was delivered saying, "Regret notify death your brother Mark." I forgot that in cablegrams, like, it was by the letter, and I was like, that's not proper English. Regret notify death your brother Mark. So later that week, Mr. Friedman said Miss Davis received a telephone call from Mr. Malam saying that the death was suspicious and the police were investigating. Mark's body was returned to Philadelphia to be cremated without any services as per his wishes. Mark left his several operas incomplete, which were commissioned by the Met Opera posthumously. And that is the life and death of Mark Beatstein.
Do you know if, like, the Portuguese and Martinique sailors were arrested at all?
Or? They were arrested. I don't know if they were ever charged. While I was looking for cases in Martinique, I typed into Google murders in Martinique. Apparently, that is a TV series.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's also a French show called Murders In, and then each week they have a murder case from a different, I guess, like, French colonial kind of area. But it's not true crime. It's, like...
Oh, it's, like, set?
Yeah. There's two... It said that there's two protagonists each episode and that they change each episode. That made it slightly more difficult because everything came up about the TV show.
Yeah, and you're like, well, I don't know if this case is true,
yeah,
because it's the TV show isn't true crime.
Yeah, it was interesting. And then there was, I can't remember what I looked up, but I clicked on something and it was like telling me like what type of like Wi-Fi and cable like Martinique has. I was like, this said murder in the
and
like.
What was it, Tegan?
I just, like, scrolled through, and I was like, this is not what I need. And then exited it. But it was, nice. Yeah, very strange. I think it was like, this is how many people live here, and this is how many people die, and this is the type of Wi-Fi we have, and this is the TV networks in our area, and this is our area zip code. But Martinique looks very beautiful, and I would like to go. We can add that to our list.
I'm looking it up. Now, like, looking at the pictures, oh my, it's so cool.
I was just looking at Martinique on my Google Maps, and I guess there's, like, a couple, I don't know why, I've never seen this before, but I zoomed out, and I have, like, two hearts in Washington State.
Oh.
And so I clicked on them, and one is the Gorge Amphitheater, which I've been to. And then the other one is a Walmart in Bellevue. What? So I don't know what I did to get that, but apparently I love Walmart in Bellevue.
You probably walked through and stood in front of the gun aisle.
Yeah, I was like,
Every time we go to the States, we have to go to a Walmart to look at the guns.
Do you actually do that?
Yes.
Oh.
When my friend Gabe and I drove down to Oregon, because he had some like grad school interviews, and I joined him, we like went to pick up groceries at a Walmart, and we're like, let's just look at the guns, and we went and looked at the guns. We were there for like 20 seconds, and then we looked at each other, and we're like, I thought this would be more impressive. Let's go.
That's so funny. Yeah.
Shall I take over my case?
I think you should.
It does involve guns, so.
Wow. What a great segue. Thank you, Walmart.
Once again, you have served your purpose. So my sources for this week are two different Wikipedia pages about Greenland and the Narsaq Massacre and the Evidence Locker podcast episode 29.
Sweet.
So my case this week is Greenland. I've actually been to Greenland. It was so pretty. Really beautiful. But yeah, I recommend anyone who wants to go to Greenland. It is quite isolated. Like, I'm fairly certain, unless you charter a flight yourself, which you probably won't, you have to get there via Denmark. So we would have to fly to Europe. Oh, you can also get there via Iceland as well.
Let's just go to Iceland and spend more than 2 hours in the airport there. And then just go over to Greenland afterwards. Sounds like a trip.
Sounds good. Okay, well, Greenland is a large country land-wise, but a very small country population-wise. It's one of the globe's most northern nations, completely above the Arctic Circle. Greenland is an island nation northwest of Iceland and east of Nunavut, Canada, and it's an autonomous nation under the Kingdom of Denmark. The majority of the landmass, so like 75%, is covered by the Greenland ice cap. It's like this massive sheet of ice that's covering most of the land. Most of the towns are along the southern coast and are covered in snow and ice for much of the year, except for in the summer months. And the average summer temperature is like 10 degrees Celsius, so still quite chilly. Most of Greenland's residents are Inuit and speak Danish, dialects of Greenlandic, and often English. When I was in Greenland, there were these two Greenlandic girls that I was friends with, and they had to speak Danish to each other because they were on opposites, like they were from different towns, and their dialects of Greenlandic were so different, like so localized that they like couldn't understand each other. So just like, let's just switch to Danish.
That is so strange.
Yeah, it's really cool.
I wonder what had to happen that, like, there was such a divide that, like, the dialects just...
I think it's just, like, people were born and raised and grew up within that one dialect.
And then just stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah.
So about one-third of the country's total population lives in Greenland's largest city of Nuuk, which lies along the southwestern coast settled between fjords and inlets. With only approximately 56,000 people in the total population, Greenland is the most sparsely populated country on Earth. For being such a small country, though, Greenland has a relatively high murder rate. And on top of that, Greenland has the highest suicide rate in the world.
What is in their water?
Years of colonial trauma is my best guess.
And being up north, probably just so much darkness.
Yeah, and being isolated. Yeah, I don't... I can't speak for anyone living in Greenland.
Yeah.
So today I will cover the Narsoq massacre on New Year's Day in 1990, or 89 to 90. Narsoq is a small town in Greenland, about 400 kilometers or 250 miles south of Nuuk. Just like Nuuk, Narsoq is situated along a fjord settled into the mountains around it and alongside the ocean, which serves as the main point of transportation to the rest of Greenland. Most of the towns in Greenland are not connected by roads at all. Like, there's roads within the towns, but between the towns, you have to take a ferry or your own boat. The population of Narsoq in 2020 was only just over 1,300 people, so very tiny town, very likely close-knit community. The town has one police station, a fire station, a grocery store, and small homes scattered throughout the small area. Some of the homes are small single-family homes, but others are more like halls or dormitories or apartments with multiple families living in connected or separated units, or there's like buildings for kind of like a share home with like different rooms for different people and like communal living spaces. On New Year's Eve 1990, 18-year-old student Abel Clemenson left his family's New Year's celebration to go to a party nearby with his older brother Christian. The party was being held at Christian's place, where he lived in a housing complex for young workers called Ungbo. Ungbo was acting as a sort of nightclub for the night, as it had rooms filled with young people celebrating. It was one of those kind of share homes that I mentioned. When Abel and Christian arrived, Abel ran into one of his friends, who we will call Trevor, because I don't think his name was ever released. Trevor came up to Abel furious because Trevor had heard about an altercation that Abel had had earlier that day with a mutual female friend. And Trevor did not like how Abel acted towards this female friend. The two of them argued and it got physical. Trevor pinned Abel up against the wall and told him that he did not want to be friends anymore. After ending their friendship, Trevor left the party. This devastated Abel. He was already a bit of a loner without many friends at school. Having lost Trevor as his friend, Abel felt like he had no one and there was no hope for him anymore. He became furious and decided to kill himself in front of everyone at the party in an attempt to get revenge on Trevor for ending their friendship. Abel left the party in a complete rage, seeing red. He stormed home, where he went to his room to retrieve his semi-automatic rifle. Because most of the population hunts and fishes for sustenance in Greenland, most people have access to a firearm or a hunting gun. Abel was no different, and once retrieving his rifle, he went back to the party. He got back to Ungbo and re-entered the party. People were still there laughing, dancing, drinking, and having a great time ringing in the new year. His brother Christian was standing near the door and saw him come in. But when Christian saw Abel, he immediately knew something was wrong. It looked like Abel was possessed. He was so angry and so different than his usual self. Before Christian could say anything, though, Abel lifted the rifle, aimed it at his brother, and shot Christian in the head. The bullet hit Christian's cheek, and he immediately crumpled to the floor as the other partiers screamed and panicked. Abel did not stop, though. He kept firing his gun, pointing it randomly at partiers and firing again and again. He followed them as they ran into the other room of the apartment, shooting off 10 rounds and ultimately shooting 6 people, all in the head. On his way out, he ran into a woman in the downstairs lounge and without hesitation shot and killed her as well. He didn't kill himself as planned. Instead, he simply walked home in the dead of night, tucking himself into bed and falling asleep once he got home. Back at the scene, however, Christian had survived only because he played dead after being shot. Once Abel had left, Christian was able to get up and run to the hospital to seek medical help and inform the authorities of what had happened. 2 of the women shot were still alive, and they were transported immediately to the hospital. One of the nurses on duty heard what happened and realized her son was at Ungbo that evening, but sadly he was one of the victims. The morning of January 1st, 1990, Abel and Christian's father was standing in the kitchen having his coffee when he saw 2 police officers approach his home. They knocked on the door and asked for Abel, informing the father of the events the night prior. Abel was arrested and interviewed, during which he said he was drunk and just couldn't control himself. The police kept him detained while they waited for a homicide team to travel in from Denmark. At this time, Denmark had a large role in Greenland's affairs and much of their criminal justice system was overseen by Denmark. In addition, the 2 surviving female victims were in need of specialized healthcare and were to be flown to Denmark to receive that special hospital treatment. But it was January in the Arctic, and the weather is cold and vicious and unpredictable, and so heavy snow came in and delayed their arrival and stopped people from coming in and out of Narsaq. While waiting for the Danish investigators, the murder scene sat untouched, and sadly, the 2 women died in hospital, succumbing to their injuries before they could be transported to Denmark. In all, there were 7 victims. Henrik Barnabasen, 24, Catherine Broberg, 18, Parnangwak Godfriedsen, 26, Jakob Grunfeld, 18, Tove Isaacson, 19, Vivian Christensen, 29, and Igged Tidesen, 33. The only survivor was Abel's brother Christian Clemensen, aged 22. The town held a joint funeral for all the victims, and nearly everyone in town attended, even Christian and Abel's parents and their other siblings. In March of 1991, over a year after the shootings, Abel was sentenced to indefinite detention at a psychiatric hospital in Denmark. He had been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, which turned out to be a reason for why he committed the heinous act. Because of this disorder, he was not able to take the rejection from his friend Trevor. So I wasn't able to find any information about where the people involved with this case are today, but apparently Abel has earned weekend release from the hospital and is living in an apartment in rural Denmark, where he spends his weekends and on the weekdays he is in the hospital. And so that is the story of the worst and only mass shooting in Greenland, the 1990 Narsaq Massacre.
Wow, that's insane. I like, it always hurts my heart when, like, everyone is so young. Like,
yeah,
they really had their lives
ahead of them. Lives ahead of them, yeah.
Oh. And, like, also, like, narcissistic personality disorder to me doesn't seem like being hospitalized instead of jailed, you know? Like, I feel like you kind of have to be a little bit more on the loopier side of things to be in the hospital rather than
go to jail. I'm not like a mental health professional, so I don't know the ins and outs of narcissistic personality disorder, but I definitely know it is like one of the most damaging to the people around them.
Yeah.
Because all they know is how to, like, manipulate other people.
Yeah. No, that's true. I just feel like if, like, you have, like, absolutely no control over, like, what you did, not because, like, more in, like, the sense of, like, you can't control your body. And, like, you're not stable enough to, like, recognize what you did. Like, those types of people, like, are put in hospital because they, like, clearly, like, are just, like, their mind is not sound.
Mm-hmm.
Where I feel with, like, narcissistic, like, you can have that disorder and not go around and kill everyone. You know? I don't know. The mind is a tricky thing.
Yeah. And also, you have to consider that Denmark's, like, prison system and, like, criminal justice system is much different to
America,
Canada, and the U.S. So I think they're much more rehabilitation focused. And actually, at this time, there was no closed prison in Greenland. So the alternative would have been him staying in Greenland, not necessarily fully in prison. Like, they had this sort of day release prisons where prisoners, like, convicted criminals would stay in the prison cell and had pretty much full autonomy, but they just had to sleep in the prison cell or, like, had to be there from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. every day.
Do they have to pay to live there?
I don't think so.
See, like, I like how they do their system over there. Like, I feel like rehabilitation is definitely something that, like, we need to focus on more here in Canada, especially for, like, small crimes.
Yeah.
But then, like, at the same sense, like, that to me, like, kind of frustrates me because I feel like they just, like, have, like, free house and board and, like, you know, meals and stuff provided to them, which, like, if you're struggling and, like, you know, you did illegal acts because that's all you could, like, do to, like, live, then yes. But, like, people, and I guess it's different too because in, like, that's the only mass murder shooting that they've ever had. And, like, their crimes are probably very different to the ones that we have in North America. So I feel like if we tried to implement that system here, it would take a long time for, like, it to ever function properly because, like, I don't think serial killers or people who, like, rapists and all that kind of stuff, like, they should not be allowed out on the street. I don't know where I'm going with this.
No. All of the tough, like, the more serious crimes were transported to Denmark to be put in prisons. In Danish prisons. So, but it was, like, the smaller, petty crimes that were allowed to, like, be in that day release. Yeah. If you want to, like, learn more about the, I guess, Greenlandic prison system and Danish prison system, there's an episode on Greenland in World's Toughest Prisons on Netflix.
Mm.
And I watched it, and it was actually very interesting to see how the prison functions. Like, Greenland just got its first, like, fully closed prison in, like, 2019 or 2018 or something. And it is so nice.
I know. I feel like I've seen, like, stuff about it, but I actually haven't, like, really looked into it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel like that just area of the world is doing a lot of things right that the rest of the world needs to follow suit on,
like Scandinavia.
Yeah, like their way with their schooling and like, how their power grids and systems and, like, their governments and everything work, I just feel like it runs better.
It's because it's, like, socialist capitalism or something. It's, like, not fully socialism, but it's not fully capitalism or, like, I don't know. I don't know enough about, like,
yeah,
like, political systems like that to, like, fully talk about it openly on a podcast, be like, I'm completely right.
Yeah, no, same. I just know that I like how their schools work.
I don't know too much about their schools.
It's not like, you have to basically do a test, I think, when, like, you're entering school to determine, like, how you kind of, like, learn. And it's not, mm-hmm. like, age group, so it's not, like, all the 13-year-olds are in the same group. Like, they're separated out by how you learn and, like, at, like, what comprehension level you're at. So it, like, focuses to, like, build you up more than kind of, like, this is the grade that you're in. And so, like, there's no, like, I guess, like, real, like, shame or embarrassment. Like, if you, like, fail a grade or, like, if you're held back, like, it's because there's no, like, oh, well, now you're, like, the oldest in, like, this group, and, like, you can clearly tell that, like, you've been held back, where it's, like, more, like, I guess you just, like, stay with groups of people that, like, you learn at the same pace in the same way as them.
What, is that a specific country? Like, Sweden, Norway?
I just know that it's somewhere in it's a Scandinavian country that does it.
I know, like, in the Netherlands, they have sort of a system like that. Like, when you're, I don't know how old you are, but, like, when you go to high school, you get sorted into three different schools. So, like, kind of three different ways of learning. Like, theoretical learning, like, kind of what our high schools are, like, learning about concepts and theories in classes. And then there's more of, like, the hands-on stuff. Like, hands-on learning, like, tech ed, like, for trades. And then there's another one that I'm not quite sure about. Like, Mike has explained it to me multiple times, but I still don't fully understand it. But it's, like, same kind of idea where you learn the way that's best for you. And so there's not as much shame in, like, failing a grade. But then the problem with it is that, like, you kind of have to choose what you'll do after high school when you're really young.
Yeah, no. That's difficult. I feel like I'm someone who, like, learns very, like, I have to, like, physically, like, it has to be tangible to me. Like, I've always, like, really, like, math and, like, calculus and stuff. Like, I just, like, I can't visualize it. And I can't, yeah, it's here. Not, like, something that I can see. So it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, that's exactly the same with me.
For people who are really bad at math, I don't understand how we always end on the subject of math.
It's because we just don't understand it.
Harry Styles is blonde now.
Oh, is he? Very fancy.
For My Policeman.
Is it, like, a bleach blonde or, like, a natural-looking blonde?
We haven't seen it yet. It's tucked underneath a hat.
Oh, how do you know he's blonde, then?
Because the character he plays is apparently blonde in this series, and since he's now filming for it, and since he's been filming, like, he sticks all of his hair up underneath a toque, and, like, usually you can see his hair, but clearly it's very, like, hidden right now.
Maybe he's embarrassed about being a blonde.
I think someone, like, took a picture of, like, I think it's going to be end up going, like, pretty blonde, because I'm not sure if, like, this was an edited picture that I saw or whatever, but I think, like, he's, like, in the process of dyeing it, so it was kind of brassy.
I see. And no one wants to be seen with brassy blonde hair.
No. So
it's like Billie Eilish dyed her hair, like, bleach blonde. And then I saw all this stuff on Snapchat, like, how did she get so blonde so fast?
She wore a wig.
She wore a wig for, like, the time in between.
Yeah.
When she was dyeing out the dark hair.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she wore a wig for, like, 2 or 3 months or something. I was scrolling through Netflix the other day. Mm-hmm. And
as you do.
As you do. And I found a movie that we have to watch. I think it's a movie. It's either a movie or a TV show. Clearly one of the two because it was on Netflix. I have to look up the name of it now because I forgot. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society.
What?
It's a movie. A London writer bonds with the colorful residents of Guernsey as she learns about the book club they formed during World War II German occupation.
Cool.
Yeah, so we definitely need to watch that. And I saw it right after, like, last week. And I was like, huh, Guernsey.
Mm-hmm.
I know some things about that place that happened there. They have little witches' nooks for the witches to sit on when they get tired.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's so cute.
I love it. I love it. I started reading Lolita.
Oh, yeah. So gross.
I immediately put it down. I decided that I am not in the space to read that book right now. It's weird because, like, when he wasn't talking about little girls, I do like the style of writing.
Yeah.
But I can't really get behind the theme of it right now. I think I kind of have to hate read it at a future date. Because I kind of think that it is something, like, I should read. And I bought
it. What is it, like, about?
It's about a love story between a grown man and a small child girl.
Ew.
Yeah. And basically, I guess, how, like, they fell in love or whatever. Apparently, I was talking to someone in my group therapy session about it, and there's another book regarding, like, the true story of Lolita, and it's basically about the kidnapping of a girl. I think it's, like, Before Lolita or something is what it's called. But I also feel like I should get that so that I can read the two together. But I decided last night that instead I'm going to read Master and Margarita. Which looks entertaining. I'm sticking to Eastern European books right now.
Ooh, interesting. Because you were, like, way over there for, like, the whole, like, 4 weeks of podcast cases. Yeah. So you're
like,
I want to read more about the area.
So I'll just read you the back of this book because it sounds, from what I can gather, have you watched Disenchantment on Netflix?
It sounds familiar.
It's like kind of like the cartoon, I think, is drawn by the same people who do Futurama.
Oh, yes, 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 okay. I have.
So one hot spring, the devil arrives in Moscow, accompanied by a retinue that includes a beautiful naked witch and an immense talking black cat with fondness for chess and vodka. The visitors quickly wreak havoc in a city that refuses to believe in either God or Satan, but they also bring peace to two unhappy Muscovites. One is the master, a writer pillared for daring to write a novel about Christ and Pontius Pilate. Pilate, and the other is Margarita, who loves the master so deeply that she's willingly, literally, to go to hell for him. What ensues is a novel in inexhaustible energy, humor, philosophical depth, a work whose nuances emerge for the first time in blah 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 blah.
In blah 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 blah.
In Diane Bergen's and Catherine Tierman's O'Connor splendid English version.
Oh, cool. It's a translated version.
Yeah, by Mikhail Buglakov.
Nice. I started reading the book that you gave me for my birthday, Point Roberts.
How are you liking it?
Alexander something.
Rigby, I think. Rigby?
Yeah. Alexander Rigby. Eleanor Rigby. Yeah, Alexander Rigby. But it's quite weird at some points. So I was like, that's kind of weird.
Weird in what way?
As in, like, not realistic.
Oh.
Like, I don't want to give too much away, but, like, there's this weird cult thing that kind of throws rocks at each other.
That's strange.
Yeah, but the whole kind of backstory of the book is that there's something suspicious going on. 18 or like 30 years or whatever after a series of murders that happened every February for 3 years.
Right.
So because of that, they locked down Point Roberts every February. But it's just very interesting to see how the author has written about the lockdown after kind of experiencing some form of lockdown.
Yeah.
For COVID. And like, I was like, okay, there would be protest. People would not be happy. Like, for example, you're not allowed to talk about the crimes for all of February. Like, it's illegal to talk about them in public. And I was like, okay, people in the U.S. would not allow that to happen. People would riot if you took away their free speech.
That is my first constitutional right.
Yeah, so I was kind of like, I wonder when the author wrote this, because it did come out like January 2021 or something.
Yeah.
So if he wrote it in 2020 at all.
He should have known better.
Yeah. So it's just kind of funny. I'm like chuckling to myself about how easily the people of town, the people of Point Roberts accept the lockdown like the lockdown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are a couple boats in the river by which I live that seem to be trolling for fish or something, because yesterday there was a boat out there and it looked like it was dragging something, and there was a whole bunch of seagulls like flocking around the back of the boat.
Yeah, they're probably fishing.
For what?
For salmon?
Here?
Question mark?
In this river?
The Fraser River is, like, the biggest river for salmon in BC. One of.
I know, but, like, in this area, just doesn't seem tangible to me.
Yeah, the fish have, like, 4 heads and 3 tails, so, you know, that's more bang for your buck.
Right, exactly.
Like, you only have to catch one fish to sell it
to
for,
a million.
You know.
I watched Seaspiracy last week. I would recommend.
I've only heard, like, negative things about Seaspiracy, that they, like, didn't fully do their research and they were pretty racist.
Yeah, I can get the racism aspect, but I definitely think that it's, like, there is some good information in there. Like, there was a huge debate in my family household for a while about straws. Because, like, yes, we all agree that we should be moving to more sustainable options for straws. But they were saying in the documentary that, like, straws aren't, like, the most, like, pressing issue that we should be concerned about. Like, it's, like, more, like, the microplastics and, like, every other piece of plastic that's going into the ocean. But, yeah, I can definitely see the racism aspect. It was interesting to watch with my roommate because we were having, like, kind of a little bit of a debate about it. But, yeah, there are some practices in other parts of the world that aren't the best.
I've seen the documentary on, like, the town in Japan that, like, bludgeons dolphins.
Yeah.
And, like, no one's allowed to go because all these filmmakers tried to go to, like, expose the practice. And now they don't let any outsiders in or something.
Yeah, that's what they were talking about.
That was pretty shocking.
That's what they were talking about in the movie.
Yeah.
They specifically talked about that. And then they also specifically talked about, like, shark fin, like, finning of...
Shark fin soup.
Of sharks. And then blue fin tuna fishing. I did not know that bluefin tuna is apparently very expensive. Like, one tuna can go for, like, $2 million.
Did they cover the, like, fish market in Japan?
They were covering the fish market in regards to finning of sharks. Because they were, like, literally actually, like, finning sharks at the market.
Were they eating the rest of the shark?
No.
I'm surprised because usually they, like, as horrible as it sounds, usually they just catch the shark, fin it, throw it in back into the water to die.
Yeah.
And not do it at a market. I've seen, like, I haven't watched it, so I can't comment on the documentary itself, but I'm in a lot of environmentalist groups, because, like, Facebook groups and stuff, because that was my undergrad degree. And all I've seen now is, like, a lot of posts about, like, Seaspiracy, how it was so off when it with its science, and how it manipulated statistics from, like, 30 years ago to, like, try to project their narrative. And, like, people in the environmentalist sphere are very upset about certain aspects of the documentary because it portrays a lot of facts wrong, and it, like, it paints environmentalist groups not in the best light. Like, I'm not sure what exactly they said, but it was, like, people were upset about how some discourse in the documentary was saying that environmentalist groups don't actually do anything. They don't actually work for the environment. They work for corporations. And it's like, no, we don't. We actually care about the environment.
Oh, well, I think, in, like, that's the hard thing, too, is that, like, there's definitely, like, when you're at the bottom of working in, like, environmental groups, like, you do care about wanting to save the environment. And I think that's what they were saying. But when you get to, like, the top of, like, big, huge, like, environmental groups, like, there is always going to be someone at the top who wants to, like, create wealth.
Exploit everything.
And exploit it. And so apparently what they were saying in a lot of the environmental groups that they did talk about, they were saying that they were owned or that they were funded by large corporations. So, like, the, like, in the UK, they have a different seal than, like, the, why can't I remember the name of it? The thing that
Ocean Wise,
the Vancouver Aquarium does that. And, like, so I trust it. But in the UK, they have a different one, and the company that gives the tuna cans that stamp of approval is funded by one of the largest fishing, like, companies in the UK. So it's kind of like, well, how can you be unbiased to giving this label out? Because it was something like, they were saying in the documentary, like, 80% of this company's money is made by giving out those stamps. Like, the environmental group is giving out those stamps to companies to say that their food is dolphin friendly or whatever, but they're also being funded by the company, the fisheries. So it's like, well, where is, like, and, like, there was, like a dolphin safe kind of program that they have. And the guy was like, well, like, we send people out on, like, boats every once in a while to make sure that, like, no dolphins get caught in the nets. But they can be bribed. And they were like, so there's no way to actually say 100% no dolphins were caught in the nets while you were fishing. He was like, no, it's 100% certainty. But you just said that the guys on the ships could be bribed, or that their lives are threatened, and, like, blah, 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 blah. He was like, no. 100% accuracy. So it's, like, very, like, I don't know. I would give it a watch. Come back next week and let me know what you think.
Maybe. I don't know if I'm, like, down to watch such a depressing documentary.
Fair enough. The world we live in.
And with that fun message, let's pull our countries.
We're leaving you more depressed this week than when you came in.
When you came. Yeah. Sorry. Okay, Tegan. You want to know where you're going next week?
Yes, please.
Okay. You, my friend, are going to Peru.
Ooh. Interesting. I've never been to Peru, but my dad has been to Peru, so maybe I can get some information from him about it.
Get some deets.
Nice.
Okay. And I am going to Albania.
Fun.
We haven't done that one, right?
No, we haven't.
You did Algeria, not Albania.
Yeah. No, cool.
They all kind of run into each other, don't they?
They do. They really do.
So, that's all for this week. Thank you for joining us here at this table where we discuss the murders of, you know, Greenland and Martinique this week. We love being in your ear holes. Ha ha.
Ha 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 ha. Did you miss us saying that?
Probably not. So we say goodbye in the language of our case. So
au revoir.
In Greenlandic, alu.
Alu.
Which means have a nice day.
Alu.
Alu.
Au revoir.
Or tacos.
Tacos.
Goodbye.
Adios, amigos. What the hell was that?
You were speaking Spanish in an Australian accent.
I don't know where my brain is today.